Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 244 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Roxana Ahmed speaks with John Sadiq about her peripatetic childhood in Pakistan, how her concern for other people motivates her to keep writing across years and genres, and how she's avoided the constraints of the post-colonial.
Today, I've travelled to London to speak with writer Roxana Ahmed about her long and varied writing career. From the comfort of her beautiful central London apartment, we discuss how, as a writer of colour, she's eschewed being drawn into the narrows of post-colonial narrative and written about what is important to her instead. We chat about what it's like to be such a multidisciplinary writer. She's written novels, short stories, plays, been a translator of poetry, and so much more. But we begin by discussing what it was that originally got her to pick her pen up to write in the first place. Hi Roxana, it's really lovely to meet you. I just wanted to begin by going back to your early days when you were studying literature and teaching a little bit yourself. And I wondered, with you being a kind of a student of literature and a teacher of literature, what it was that moved you to pick your pen up.
Actually, the literature department induced a real silence in me, I have to say, because I was so much in awe of real literature and so much in awe of the people who lived in London who wrote and published, that I don't think I had the courage to write very much at that point. I'd started writing a short story, which got finished many years later, and I'd done some translations, and that's all, because I think at that time Manto was a great favourite of mine. So one of my tutors encouraged me to do the translation, so I did. But I felt too intimidated by writing as a process. I started writing as a child. At the age of 10, I started doing my very first novel, if you like. Unlike the Brontes, it wasn't a great work of art. It was, I'm pleased to say, destroyed or lost at some point in my childhood. But it was called, I think, Autumn Leaves. And it was going to be a story about a sickly heroine who's very much in love, very Victorian in its thinking. So that's when I first started writing. And I think the interesting thing about that piece of writing is that it was in Urdu.
And this was in Karachi at the time.
In Karachi, I was in Karachi. I was born in Karachi, but we had quite a peripatetic childhood, with my father being moved around quite a lot. So every 3 years we'd go to different places. And we have lived in Lahore quite a lot, and Rawalpindi, and also what was formerly East Pakistan, and the one or two smaller stations, but mostly in Karachi, and I'm very, very fond of Karachi for that reason.
Obviously, with travelling around so much, and then kind of later on, you kind of moved to London as well. How does kind of being a traveller kind of fit into the writing? Because does that have an effect?
I think it does, because I think it teaches you that there are different kinds of places and there are different kinds of peoples everywhere. It is also, if you like, something that develops your sensitivity to class and race much more than if you were stationary. Let's say if you were born in London and lived in London all your life, your experience and knowledge of people is likely to be a bit more confined, unless, of course, you have a huge fund of empathy and read a lot. But we didn't have that experience. We were quite middle class, I think, or low middle class, I should say. But my father came from a working class background, rural background. And my mother's family came from Delhi, and they were kind of low middle as well. I mean, I think they became lower middle by virtue of the debts of the breadwinner, because in those days life expectancy in the subcontinent was perhaps 40, 45 for men. I'm talking about my grandfather's time, and both of them were children of widows. So our family had a sense of empathy, if you like, for the poor, but it was quite rigidly structured in terms of class. And I think that always troubled me as a child. I think I always saw the injustices that happen on a day-to-day basis to people who are working class and poor in Pakistan.
And this comes through, you know, when I was reading your stories, yes. The Gatekeeper's Wife,
yes.
And the class stuff is definitely one of the themes,
yes.
In there that kind of comes through a lot, and this kind of disparity.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And it's the disparity is something that you become very aware of also if you live in the West, because you're constantly comparing. If you travel every year to Pakistan and you see the destitution and the limitations that people have to experience over there. For example, there are people who will not have running water or electricity. For example, there will be very strict controls on how much water they can expend. These are really kind of very basic necessities, and these are not yet equal in the world. And so that, I find that quite distressing at a certain level. I mean, there's the corrupt, luxury-loving part of me that is quite happy to go out and eat a meal outside. But there is the socially conscious, conscientious part of me that really hates the disparity, and I would love it to not be there.
And was this part of you there when you first started writing?
Yes.
That was always one of the drivers.
That is indeed one of the main drivers in my work. I would love to say that I am an idealist artist in that sense, who has this dream of beauty and is writing purely with an aesthetic ideal, but I'm not, alas. I'm always inspired by injustices to write something that will produce a certain sense of empathy. Hope. The hope is always that there is an optimist in me, a foolish optimist I'm beginning to see as I get older, that thinks that maybe things will improve, maybe somebody will become sensitized. But I think I have been sensitized by books myself, so that gives me hope.
Is that something that you loved about reading, the
yes.
sensitization process of reading
yes.
literature?
Yes, the thing that you could connect with people, you could connect with a Juliet if you read Romeo and Juliet. Or you could connect with a small Hindu child. Don't forget, my childhood was quite early on after partition. There was still quite a lot of vehement bitterness, if you like, against the other. And the Hindus and the Indians were set up as the other, Hindus, Sikhs, Christians, whoever, because Pakistan has grown more and more monochromatic over the years, but it was already there. But I could see, because through stories, I could see that there was a human connection that went far beyond that difference. And I think this thing is quite important to me to set up in my writing. I can never write from one point of view. I tend to write from multiple points of view. All my stories even have more than one point of view, mostly 99% of stories have.
And that's so you can explore those distinctions?
Yes, so that you can contain within it all the dichotomies, all the oppositions, all the complexity of life.
Mm.
I feel that the style of writing, which is purely about love between men and women and, you know, this kind of romantic fiction that one read as a child, which I got past quite soon, I think, in my early teens, I was bored of that already. And the detective fiction, which kind of heroizes one person, was not for me.
I would like, if you could, just talk us through a little bit your kind of development as a writer, because there are so many, you've branched out into so many areas. It's just quite incredible. But something you've just said makes me kind of reflect about when you move away and you lose your friends, and also that within the characters that I've read of yours, isolation is another one of your themes.
Mm-hmm.
So has reading and writing been your friend then as you've travelled?
Absolutely. I think I enjoy reading immensely. I think I have been erratic over the years. When the children were little, one had much less time. But on the whole, I think reading has been a great escape, and so has writing been. With writing, I think the bigger opportunities for me came from the theatre. And because the income matters, when you are in the sort of situation that I am in, you have to justify your time away from home. And the credibility comes a little bit from the income. And also, I think in terms of how others see you. If they feel that you are earning from your work, then you must be an okay sort of writer. Now, this is a really foolish assumption that readers make, because there are some very successful writers who write real trite stuff, real trash. And I hate to trash other people's work, but you know what I mean. A lot of work that gets read and pays so well actually is not worth the paper it's written on, is it?
Absolutely.
But it is entirely to do with the level of education that we impart to our children, that not everybody has a true understanding of what's worth publishing and what's worth reading.
We'll talk about this more off tape. You've avoided being a post-colonial writer, I feel, and this is something I've enjoyed very much in reading you. Before we kind of started recording, we were talking about this a little bit, that you have kind of colonial writing with all its coding and all that stuff that goes on, and then you have post-colonial writing, which is literally reaction to colonialism in a way, but that actually continues the same narrative. And you've not done that, and you're one of the few writers I've come across of colour that haven't done this. I hope we get more of it as time goes on. We'll have to see how things go. But were you aware that you weren't taking part in the post-colonial narrative, and how have you managed to keep yourself clear from it?
I think by just having a political sense of what it is and what to avoid, I think what I retained, because I grew up over there and also had a profound respect for Urdu literature, which I read quite a lot, and which I also keep at par with English literature in that sense of I do have the same respect for the very good Urdu writers as I would for the very good English writers or Scottish writers or Welsh writers or Asian writers. I felt that it was really important to keep a sense of my work being its own thing. It is something that has its own integrity, does not need explaining. It should stand on its own. And perhaps one of the works that does succumb to the colonial project a little bit is the translations that I did, We Sinful Women. Because in that collection, and I did not realize it then, I was directed into taking it in a certain way. I was asked to give it a context that would make it much more understandable for the reader in the West. And that, whilst that made perfect sense, and because it was also written a little bit with a sense of outrage against how little feminism from the East was appreciated or understood.
Absolutely.
It was actually targeted at white feminists. It was saying to them, look, we've got an indigenous movement in Pakistan which is resisting Ziaul Haq's rule, which is resisting the Islamization program, which is fighting patriarchy on its own terms. I wanted very much to address that question. It ended up being a little bit of a post-colonial book in that sense. And it's interesting, it got taught on a lot of post-colonial courses and also feminist courses, because it does present the best side of Urdu poetry, where you have a wonderful set of women poets whose work was translated. But I think about the time when I'd finished writing and publishing that book, I came across a piece by Gayatri Spivak which said that Western feminism had used Indian literature or literatures of the world as a process of collection, as a harvesting project, so that they take it and induct it into their own. It becomes part of their canon in that way. And I rather regret that aspect of the work, because by labelling those women as feminist poets, what I'd done was excluded the fact that they are very rounded poets who do all kinds of poetry, you know. And because they were put in that frame, later on some of them felt a bit uncomfortable with that. But I think other than that, most of the work has been very committed to itself. And I think in my second novel also, whatever I mentioned or whatever I write about, it's written without any translations or glossaries.
No, you don't explain things away, and you expect the reader to do their part of the work.
Yes.
Which is rare now, I find, and it's something I appreciate very, very much as a reader. It's wonderful, and Yeah, you know, the writer's job is not to explain ourselves away. Mm-hmm.
Well, as a minority ethnic reader, I've always done it. I came across a number of French and English words that I didn't know as a child, and I had to always look them up. And I did the hard work, and it paid dividends.
Yeah.
Because when you learn the meaning for yourself, rather than deduce it from your context and surroundings, you do come at it a bit more accurately.
Yeah, yeah, so, absolutely. Yes. So it's part of the process. So you move from Karachi, you come to London, and your writing seems to blossom into so many different directions. You're translating, you're editing, you're writing plays. You were writing plays before you started writing, before you wrote your stories and novel.
I started writing stories first.
Okay.
And then I think Tharad said asked the Asian Women Writers Workshop if there were any writers interested in working with them. And he, Jatinder Verma, had asked for submission of stories. And I sent my first story, I think. And he invited me to a meeting and commissioned me, and therefore the theatre work, because I was like, I've never done a play. And he said, well, everybody has to start with their first play, which is the logical thing. And I think I really, really enjoyed working in that way, because it was an improvised piece based on research done by the actors and myself and the director. And it was a really interesting way of working. And it was very exciting because it was also much easier than going away and having to write everything yourself. So after I watched the improvisations, I had to do a piece based on the improvisations.
So it was kind of devised from improv work, yeah.
Devised, but from the devised work, I drew a script and then it was scripted and rehearsed. So the script was commented on by them. It was a school's piece, but it really inducted me into the work in a very easy way. And I think they then subsequently commissioned two or three other pieces. And also then I think immediately I started getting requests from other regions, where whenever they asked for somebody, they were looking for somebody Asian to come in and do a piece, Jatinder would recommend my name kindly, and I would keep getting the work. So I never pestered him to go on their main stage. I just went away quietly. But I was really assisted in that process of being found and being recruited and working with them. Those were happier times for writers, because there wasn't such a division between Indians, Muslims, Hindus and Sikhs as there is now. There is a nasty attitude towards Muslim writers now, which did not exist at that time. And I'm uncomfortable with the divisions, because I really learned so much from losing my own parochialism. When I first started writing, don't forget I came from a fairly limited background myself, in the sense that I was a mainstream person from Pakistan. My thinking was very mainstream. I never thought about what it is to be in a minority in any sense. So coming here and working here had made me suddenly see that A, I am a minority here, and B, what it is to feel marginalized. So those were happier times when one connected with everybody who was ethnically Asian, whereas now it has become much harder. Some people do. There are plenty of people who are still friends and who I can work with happily. But there are also plenty of people who kind of turn up their noses, because India's trajectory has been so different from Pakistan's. Most of the time in my writing, I'm trying to find answers for myself. I feel that writing helps me resolve questions that worry me, or questions to which I'm looking for answers.
And do you find that by having kind of diametrically opposed characterizations, you put them together and the story kind of produces itself somehow?
Yes, I think it gets easier. It's also harder, because you can make it too simplistic.
Yeah.
And I think what you want is the subtlety of each position to appear. And in theatre, I think it's usually important to have that conflict, because without the conflict, you don't get the drama that you need. And I think it is easier to do in the novel, because a novel enables you to be subtle. A novel has the space for complexity, for layering, much more than theatre does. Theatre does too, but theatre doesn't give you that much time to go internal into your characters. the great advantage of the novel is that you are inside a character's head. Mm. And this is something that it has in common with radio drama as well. I loved doing radio drama and I've done a lot of it. Some really good adaptations of some wonderful books that I chose. Some books were offered to me and I did not decline because that was my bread and butter at one time. And I've enjoyed doing all kinds of work on radio for this reason, because it gives you so much time and space and you can just move like you do in the pages of a book from one setting to the next in the flick of an eye. And it's a very enjoyable medium for that reason.
Yeah, you translate, you adapted White Sargasso Sea.
Yes, White Sargasso Sea was one of my pitches, which I loved doing, because I think it is one of those rare things, which doesn't happen so much in radio now. I was very annoyed once when somebody said to me, oh, will you do such and such kind of colonial British novel, which is set in India. I said, why don't you ever ask me to do Middlemarch? You'd never ask me to do Middlemarch, which was my favorite book of all times, and it remains still a big favorite. Because I think we have this sense in radio of who does what well, and it's very hard to transcend that.
And once you've gone into a box, that's it. You're in that box forever, aren't you?
And sometimes you're lucky to be in that box, because sometimes you get offered work, which other people can do quite comfortably, but it's offered to you because you're an Asian.
Mm.
And I suppose you bring to it a deeper knowledge of the culture. So I have done things like Midnight's Children and Nadeem Aslam's Maps for Lost Lovers, which I loved, which was a 10-parter. And I remember I hadn't read the book when I was rung and asked, would you like to do this? And I said, oh yes, I'm in the middle of reading it. And I dashed out and bought a copy. And I enjoyed it, and I thought it was a struggle to get into that book because it's quite elaborate and subtle writing. But once you're into it, it does suck you in. It's a great novel. And I think then I've done things like The Far Pavilions, which is a very kind of English project, which is like one of these. I would classify it as a late Victorian novel, although it probably came out in the 70s. Because in the 70s, it was written by a woman who was 70, or some astonishing age. It was her first book. And I think its mindset is very pre-colonial, I should say. Perhaps colonial?
Yeah, during the colonial time.
Yes, yeah. It's very colonial.
So at the moment, you've got this play that you're working on.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also finishing up a novel, aren't you? I was just wondering if you could describe to us, you know, what your sort of writing day looks like. What's your kind of structure like? That's always a thing that I find interesting. You know, how do other writers live? You know, how do they structure their day?
I'm afraid I'm a nocturnal writer, so I tend to, and that's kind of a habit that happened when the children were little, and also because I'm a natural procrastinator, I find it easiest to do everything else that needs to be done before I do the writing. So it's still a very nocturnal structure. I tend to start in the afternoon, about 3-ish, do a couple of hours, have a longish break, then work after 9 or 10 and work through the night.
Really?
Yes. So I start my morning quite late, about 11 or something. But it depends also on deadlines. If I'm up against a deadline, then I will stay up all night. I might finish at 6 a.m.
Wow.
And I might work through the day as well. But I tend to do less in the daytime. I tend to do more of my admin. And there's always so many chores to do around the place, the work, letters to write and stuff.
And so just one final question. You know, what would you say to anybody listening to this who wants to have a long creative career? Because you have longevity in your career. You know, some people, it's just one book or there's a kind of a bright spark of time and then it kind of fades away and they keep on turning out the same thing almost. You know, people write the same book over and over again or variations of, or don't. They kind of just disappear. And yet you've managed to stay fresh and to kind of explore different things, and yet I can feel that the same heart, the same kind of, you know, younger heart is kind of still beating in the writing. You know, how have you done that? What would you say to somebody who kind of wants to kind of go for the lifetime stretch of being a creative being?
I don't know if I'm a good person to give you advice on that, because although it's been a long career, it doesn't feel amazingly successful. It have had successes, and I enjoy the ones I have had and hope to have. But I think it's largely about generating the ideas and being passionate about them. I think I've never really felt I'm out of things to write about. I feel like there have always been things I've been passionate about, and that interest is fed by many things, but mostly my concern for others. I'm not trying to present myself as more altruistic than other writers. I'm just saying that if you are interested in the outside world, then you're much less likely to dry up. You're more likely to dry up if you're only writing about yourself and your predilections and your preoccupations. I'm constantly interested in others. And that may be something that women do more easily because they're taught to care for others. I don't know how much of it is to do with a sexist upbringing, because if there is a sexist upbringing, I've had one of the most sexist upbringings you can think of. Ours was quite an orthodox family. But I think just being interested and just reading a lot, and also having a diverse palette, it has helped. Being able to work in so many different genres is a good thing. I do get bored of things easily. So if I'm doing a play, I might keep thinking, oh, I wish I was doing a novel because that's much more fun, or that's easier. And if I'm doing a novel, I might say, oh, I wish I was doing some radio. I wish I was doing a screenplay. So this is what keeps me going. I went back to university, I think, must have been in my 50s, to study screenwriting, because I felt like I didn't know enough about it and I wanted to do that, get that art form. And it is a completely different art form to literary work, whether it's literature or theatre. And I feel that it gave me another kind of axe to grind.
And have we got a film coming then? Is there something in the works?
Not yet. I mean, I've got a screenplay coming, but whether it ever becomes a film is anybody's guess. Because I think this is the thing. You have to stay optimistic and hopeful. And films are one of the hardest things to pull off. And films are much more dependent on a market structure than even books. So it is going to be, on the one hand, it's harder to get independent production, but on the other, it is also now in some ways easier because of the modes of production. It may be possible that I'd get a film together, or it may be just a pie in the sky. Who knows? It keeps me going.
Thank you, Roxana.
Thank you. Been a pleasure talking to you.
That was Roxana Ahmed in conversation with John Siddiq. You can find out more about Roxana on her website at www.roxanaahmad.com. That's Roxana spelt R-U-K-H-S-A-N-A. And that concludes episode 244, which was recorded by John Siddiq and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 245, Caitlin Davies and her father Hunter Davies let us eavesdrop on a conversation about their respective writing careers, being compulsive writers in a family of writers, and generational changes in the publishing industry. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.